I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the CollectingCars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Welcome back to the Goodwood Racing Circuit. It's a doubleheader. So last week you heard Sam Hancock and myself and Edward. But this week it's been recorded a couple of hours after that one. We're still at Goodwood. I'm here with Sam Hancock. That's at at Hancock underscore Sam.
Yes,
got it right,
thank
but
you.
I always have a stammer. And I'm really, really chuffed for this one because this is great. We've got Tiff here. We've got Tiff Nidell, who I presume is at Tiff Nidell on Twitter, are you?
You have to underscore, don't you? At Tiff underscore TV.
Well, who else is called Tiff Nidell?
Oh, well, I went for the TV bit. You see, my website is tiff.tv. Therefore, my Twitter is tiff underscore TV.
So for anyone listening to this, Tiff needs no introduction. And for me, as the person that's supposed to marshal this activity, it's going to be a tough one because squeezing words out of Tiff is like getting blood from a stone. He's just not willing to talk about anything or himself. He's just a quiet man. Really, it's fantastic to have you here because, you know, you're one of the people that created the industry in which we all thrive. And we can't quite believe that you're still going, but you seem to get younger, thinner, lither, faster as time goes on. What have you just been driving here today?
Peter Pan syndrome, that's what I go for. Yeah, and that beeping thing. Why do people, that's going to, electric cars going to be like that
well,
soon.
We're just,
you know? Everything
yeah,
has
we'll
to make
have,
a noise when it reverses.
It's already started.
Fantastic. I'm driving a lightweight E-Type. I do three races at Goodwood this year. One little saloon car, which I don't even know yet, I've been introduced to. A DB4 lightweight in the Kinrara on the Friday night. And this TT, a lightweight E-Type. In the Tourist Trophy. And E-Types around here to me are the best cars to drive around Goodwood. I mean, I've driven them before and I just think they're perfect Goodwood cars.
They are mega, aren't they? Because they have that balance where you can just get the thing set and steer it on the right foot and then it's just gorgeous, isn't it?
And it is about power and chassis handling. The people in modern industry, motorbikes, they're noisy as well. Torque, everyone gets excited. Journalists, it's got so much more torque. You know, we've got more torque now. I've raced a Cobra round here, you know, and people don't understand there is a thing as too much torque.
Yeah.
And with the E-Type coming out of the second Lavant, you snick it up into third gear, you're already in your opposite lot from second gear, and then you just drift it progressively through the second half of Lavant that starts the straight. Whereas a torquey Cobra with a big violent V8, it's just snap, snap, snap. You can't actually, nobody can balance the throttle and progressively slide.
When you follow a Cobra in a race, it just looks like the bloke's having a fight with it. Well, it could be a woman, but it just looks like a slightly disorganised fight. I always admire them when I see them, but I think I'm really glad I'm in this Jaguar and not in that bloody tank.
They do move around a lot, but I thought this yesterday, a lot of that movement is throttle instigated.
Is it?
So you expect the guys to fall out of the cars knackered, these Cobra drivers, but actually it's just right foot movement that pivots.
Does it?
So much of the yeah, car's
you
movement.
Need a throttle. Throttle that's got about 12 inches of movement, really.
A TVR throttle.
As soon as you touch a torque.
Remember TVRs, the Tuscans? You used to go, am I there?
Yeah.
And, oh, it's down there somewhere.
Oh, right. Tuscan racing.
So
oh,
we'll get you
onto
that in a minute. Now, look, you are, without a doubt, the original racing driver journalist, and I'll sing your praises more in a minute, but just give us, if you can, I'm not sure, brevity's not your thing, Tiff, give us 3 or 4 minutes as to how you ended up on the telly box driving around and talking about cars, and how did you get there? Because I'm not sure everyone knows unless they've read your book, which is available in all good bookshops.
It is, and very cheap on Amazon now.
Yep,
as well.
Yep, go on.
It was simply because a regular Top Gear presenter, Chris Goffey, broke his leg ice skating the week before he was going to test the Formula First racing car. And I'd already been with the BBC doing Murray Walker, expert analyst of live Formula 2, Formula 3. When James Hunt was the Grand Prix analyst.
You were
James Hunt couldn't be bothered to all the nationals. So I did rallycross, touring cars, because all those were live on Grandstand. Yeah. Wonderful live TV. So the BBC had my name and they'd heard me talk. And I was writing track tests for Autosport magazine at the time. Just any job as usual and still doing it now. Earn another dollar somewhere. So, you know, the producers of Top Gear read my stories in Autosport. They'd heard my voice on the Grandstand doing the commentary. So they just called me straight up and, can you drive for us this weekend at Brands Hatch in the Formula First? So I was in.
What year was that?
Oh, I don't know about that. 87.
I was going to say, I can tell you, because I remember that onboard video Formula 4 test, and you taught me everything about Brands and how to drive a racing car and change gear and check my revs on the exit of paddock to see if I'd come out quicker in fourth, not third, or whatever it was. And I must have watched that 100 times over, and that, I think, was 88 or something, because my dad did Formula First. And that's why I saw it.
But it was actually quite funny because before I did that film, you know, we all watched Grand Prix drivers on television. And I always get a bit embarrassed sometimes because it does look a bit easy. You know, you look at Lewis Hamilton now chasing down, you know, Verstappen to Hungary, absolutely on the limit. And it's so non-visible with the power steering, especially deadening the steering. He just turns in, turns out. So before I went there, I thought, well, look, I've got to make this look exciting. So I deliberately did the oversteering moment. So right from the word go, I'd started the power
sliding.
You were
a pantomime dame from the start.
Even though I actually knew, and maybe this is where your dad went wrong, Sam, he copied that you shouldn't really be that sideways in a single-seater racing car.
So a generation of young racing drivers basically yes. were taught to drive like rock apes because you wanted to make some good television.
But funnily enough, it actually backfired things. When I did more and more Top Gear, I thought, this is brilliant now. They'll want a Top Gear presenter. All the professional teams will be hiring me for touring cars or whatever. But in fact, I think the team manager's seen me and thinking, look, but no, we don't want him driving like that. Yeah. But obviously, I wouldn't drive like that in a race.
Maybe a load of your engineers thought, now we know what the problem was. He's been a rock ape all this time.
So but then they were so impressed that they then asked me back to do. And that first item, I never took my helmet off. Chris Goffey still presented the item. Bizarrely, I was the Stig that talked.
Were you?
Yeah, because I never saw my face. Item number one, if you watch it back, it's just me doing the onboard talking and driving and Chris Goffey doing the presenting of the item. So it was a helmet on show. Only the second show did you finally reveal the true, handsome, gallant face of young Tiff Needell.
Deary me. So from my perspective, what always stood out for me was there was this bloke that could drive. You know, I loved the entertainment side. They had other characters, whether it was, you know, the Goffey era or the Woolard era. Then you moved to Jeremy and you had Quentin and the others and some great chemistries there that get forgotten because of the profound success of the Three Amigos over the last 15, 20 years. But, you know, before that, you know, in the 90s when it was you guys, it was a big show and you were real personalities and it was huge. But I always gravitated towards what Tiff did because there was this bloke that could drive. And of course, it's ironic that we're here at Goodwood because there's one film that above all others, that 94, you come here in a McLaren F1 and I still can't believe that. It just looked violent. You were just wrestling this bloody thing around the track and it was pitching and yawing and doing one tyre smokers because it had no diff in it. And I remember thinking, and that was the moment I thought, I'm doing that. I'm doing that for a living. Well, I don't. If that bastard gets paid to do that, then I'm doing that.
But you look at that now, that chassis pitching and rolling, as you say, you know, compared to a modern supercar, it looks horrendous, doesn't it? That, at the time, that was brilliant, you know.
You must have thought this could fall off at any point.
It was a bit of a wild lap. But, you know, then the producers, you know, they let me do another lap. And the old days, you know, the 90s of Top Gear, they did let you have an 11-minute item, you know, on a car like that. Whereas now I find the items are cut down, you get 7 minutes or 6 minutes, you know. So I think people love that. I did one wild lap and then did another, you know, another wild lap, which nowadays would be cut and into pieces. Also, I did the item, we started looking at the way it was built. We actually went through the process of building, went shopping in it.
Yeah.
And then we had the wham at the end. was I found nowadays, modern producers, they want you, you've got to start the item sideways, smoking tyres.
Yeah,
you know, don't let you build it.
A lot of that's come from the YouTube side, yeah, where you had to get, you know, Neil and I worked out early on that you had to get a money shot, as we call it, early on to get the attention. Then you, then the retention's there.
Yeah.
But if you left it too late, I think certain people on Top Gear refer to it as getting, you know, get your shiny fruit, yeah, out the front.
Well, Fifth Gear was the same. I mean, the funny thing with that idol is, again, because it built up slowly, so many people remember the moment on the dual carriageway when I turned and said, but what I've been waiting to do and what you've all been waiting to do is this. And yeah, I nailed. So the first time I nailed the throttle was halfway through the item almost, you know, and then we were off and running. And
I suppose it was a gentler time for gentler television, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But that, but what, Chris, what you've gone on to do with all your slidey stuff, particularly on YouTube, being a whole programme in that style, is what we always wanted Top Gear to be when we were watching TIFF. It was the last 5-10 minutes of the show normally where suddenly, finally, TIFF would be given the keys to something exciting and you'd go drifting around mountainous hairpin bends. And I remember speaking to mates at the time thinking, we need to make a show that's just like that from start to finish, because that's the only bit worth watching.
Now, well,
that was the bit, you know, I loved the other presenters, obviously, because it was a car show. And people who have YouTube now, and just the limitless amounts of car media, won't realise what it was like. If you were a teenager in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s like me, there was nothing. You had car magazines. They came out once a month. So you'd buy car, performance car, Fastlane. That'd be done in a day. So they're done. There was no internet, no nothing. So, you know, you couldn't just go online and have a look at a video of a Lotus 79 or a Porsche 917 or TIFF sliding around. You had to wait for your fix of Top Gear. Because then it would arrive. And you would have to go through the motor show report, and then there'd be, you know, one leg up on a bumper talking about boot space. And it was a bit like a really unfortunate bag of wine gums. You know, you want a red or a black one, but there was an awful lot of yellows and greens to get through to actually get to the bit that you wanted.
Here we go, smoke.
But
also the lovely thing, that the cars used to all slide and handle. And this is the funny thing now. I mean, unless it's a hypercar with mega power, there aren't many normal cars that you can pitch in and play with and slide around, because you can't turn half the autonomous.
But if we're honest with you, do we cover those normal cars
anymore?
We don't. We just, sadly.
You just mentioned, but I've got to go back 2 minutes. You mentioned the Lotus 79. I was bleeding for you when I saw you with shiny, shiny, slick tyres.
In the rain. God,
your opportunity to drive that car.
Such is life.
You made a great job, I have to say, but I know what I would have felt like.
It was wet, and I did one skid, which they recorded. So that wasn't made up. And I did one skid coming out of the hairpin at Hethel. And I just thought, if I get this wrong, it's going to be a hell of a news story.
Chance to drive that iconic car, you know. Because I drove that Williams Formula One car for fifth year. You know, I still remember that. To get given that, I was about 52 years old or something, and Williams agreed to be driving their Grand Prix car in this comparison to the M5. Vicky driving the M5, and I had to do 3 laps before she did four laps before three. And just to be put back in a Grand Prix car. But, you know, my neck was gone in 2 laps. I couldn't keep my head up straight. And I was wailing around.
I drove the, and I can't say too much, but I drove the IDR, the crazy Volkswagen thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Electric that went up the hill. Mm. I drove that for the TV show a couple of weeks ago. And I couldn't get all the way around the circuit we were on. I got 3/4 of the way around, and I had to just do the thing where you leave your neck. I haven't built my neck up at all. I'm reasonably chunky and strong. But the thing's pulling 5 Gs everywhere.
Neck goes.
And the braking performance is just absurd. I've never driven a car with brakes like that. And it's doing 0 to 125 in under 5 seconds. It's quicker than an F1 car accelerating. If you're not conditioned for it, you can't do it.
No, I was gone.
But to come back to it. So there was this bloke, right, who had this incredible vocal range, and his voice would go up and down, and he could really pedal, and he could talk at the same time, and not many drivers could. You know, we'd always seen racing drivers that could make the car look expressive and drive it, but they couldn't talk. So we'd have sort of, you know, wee Jackie now and again would do something, wouldn't he? But he'd be like, nah, I can't. But this was the man. He was the progenitor of everything that you see on YouTube. Every idiot you see like me going sideways, you're responsible for.
The daddy of the Stigs.
Yeah.
Guilty.
And I
hope you know that. But the thing is, I love the fact that you rage against age, don't you? You rage against it. In your head, you're still 30, aren't you?
You're not even that old, no. I mean, I just love driving cars. I'm not really a car fan, because I'm a racing driver.
We discussed this with Sam on the previous podcast. You know, don't make the mistake of thinking that racing drivers are into cars. In many respects, road cars are totally boring to them, because they are so flawed and crap.
I read your tweets about Porsches, and what's a 962B4 GT? And he's you know, he's absolutely raving. Oh, God, I saw a 9.68. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. They're either 9.11s or they're not. And I've just never had a passion for road cars. And I feel guilty sometimes because the fans all think, you know, I've got this huge passion. They are literally machines to take me from A to B because I've had so much luck. And obviously, I've driven all these fantastic cars on tracks and raced. And I just enjoy getting to anything and driving it to the limit and feeling what it does underneath it.
But you would get into M5s and slide them around and enjoy that.
Yeah, I think that was the first drifting video. I think the M5 would have that big circle non-stop with the tyres smiling. That was the first time cars in. We was comparing it with a Merc. I don't know which Mercedes it was.
E55.
So we had that drift under a boom for the first time where I came fully sideways. Now, that was about the first drifting on telly, I think, which kicked it all off, as you say. But the trouble is, then I had to slide everything. I was doing 360 spins in Bentley Continentals and I hate to know what that did to the chassis because the slow-mo showed all the wheels. I had four of us on board doing a 360 spin at the camera and the noise from what we were, I don't think a Bentley ever survived.
So when it was you, Jeremy, Vicky and Quentin as the main hosts, you were a famous man, weren't you? It was a big show and I presume you got a fair amount of publicity and you got a lot of attention out and about.
But not the sort of corporate work. The funny thing is we had the same sort of 6 million audience or something in the mid-90s. But there wasn't. We didn't have the extra work, which comes nowadays. You get offered lots of corporate deals and stuff.
No,
the more, you know, handsomer one, the better looking.
The other two get loads.
So although we were very famous, we didn't really know it. I mean, you know, there was no real recognition. We didn't go on any chat shows or we didn't go on any game shows or we didn't go on any reality. So I didn't really know how famous we were, apart from when you sort of met people shopping in the supermarket.
But it's all, the idea of a car show has always been so non-BBC, hasn't it? It's always been this thing that they go, we can't believe it's so popular, but it's there and they can just do what they want, really. So were you out of Pebble Mill at that point? Or were
wonderful Pebble Mill for years, you know, but very low budget. It was always, you know, the salaries we had then were a joke compared with what was some of them. I mean, obviously you don't, but, you know, Freddie and sort of money other people get. There was no money in it. Every show, it was so funny. I can remember talking to Rory Reid recently, a while ago, because I talked about all my life. It's been one day to film a story with one cameraman, one sound man, one director and me, four of us. I said to Roy, now, what's it like Top Gear? You know, because it was just after, in fact, he'd done his first item and he looked a bit surprised at me. He said, well, we went to New York for 5 days and there were 20 crew. I dreamed of doing that once in my life. And it's changed a lot. I mean, obviously, you've got a big crew now and Clarkson's more of quite a big crew. Do you still go out with little small crews and do a little story on your own?
I try and persuade them to do smaller stuff, but they would never do one camera anymore. They'd always have a minimum of two cameras. And you'll always end up with 10, 15 people, which is what happens. But the web stuff I still do with Nilo, and that is very much, you know, just the two of us. Maybe one might have one other person do a bit of tracking driving.
Sometimes it's simpler. Sometimes I get very jealous of these big crews.
No, I think it's nice to have both. What you tend to crave is the thing that you've not got at that time. So when you've got a massive crew, you're like, God, this is slow moving. The inertia is terrible. We're not making flowing television here. It's just too static and it's punctuated the whole time by having to move this enormous bunch of people everywhere. And then when you're on your own, you think, oh, God, I wish I had three
other
cameras.
Someone make a cup of coffee for me.
Where's my sushi?
Yeah.
But it's a big old beast now, and it just takes time. And of course, what the audience wants from a Top Gear is very different from what it wanted back then. You know, they want an entertainment show. They want the laughs. You know, if we start, what you were doing was, you know, you were the beginning end of making it entertainment. You know, we were sharing the joy of you driving this car in an exuberant fashion. But now the audience would view that as probably being too sterile. Yeah. You know, it's too much about the car. I mean, if I talk for more than 30 seconds about a differential, the other two just say, oh, shut him up.
Well, those two that bully, I'm very sad. I'm very worried for you, Chris.
I read
on the internet that you're being bullied.
I'm badly bullied. And as you can imagine, I'm easily bullied.
I can see what a little flower you are.
Absolutely terrified. When that came out, it was absolutely hilarious. Because I did, much as they love to publicise the fight, I did go to a boarding school and I did get the shit kicked out of me most days, largely because I'm a chippy little bastard. And so when someone, there's nothing like, and I've got a little bit of a tan about me the whole time, and I love the fact that the people that were outraged on my behalf were normally sort of middle class white males saying, you're being bullied. You know, I'll decide whether I'm being bullied or not. I really am
but,
not.
But you still have to do a few things that you probably don't like doing yourself, and you have to go with the role at times. I mean, I remember seeing light bulbs on your head.
Yeah, but they stopped all that.
So you must have not enjoyed that.
No, I said to Alex Renton, you'd probably know Al, and I said at the beginning when I agreed to do Top Gear, I said, I'm not I'm not doing any of the silly stuff. I'm not interested in that at all. I'll road test the cars and I'll go along on a trip. And I was stood there wearing the Pantometer 3000 with a pair of, and I'm like, what's happened to me? And he said, well, just trust us. But it did work for those films. But the beauty of the two new ones is they're so naturally funny. We can do some straighter stuff. You can go and do the Lotus 79 now without cocking about. It's a straight love story.
Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm.
You can go and do that because, frankly, McGuinness and Flintoff are hilarious and they make the other stuff funny. So it was a brave choice. I'm happy with what they did. I'm in another era. I'd like Top Gear to be you, me, and a couple of other, and a Plato, and a load of blokes that love the same thing. But it would be probably quite one note because we kind of like the same things, and our approach to cars would be turn up, have a massive race, see who doesn't die. That would happen
then,
on a weekly basis.
And then talk about whether or not the ratios were appropriate.
And then whinge about who had the best car. Yeah. So you got to. Sometimes you have to step back and trust people that are higher up the food chain and what they know works for an audience. Sometimes they get it completely wrong. And
I've got that in fifth gear actually. The moment somewhere up the food chain thinks they know what fifth
gear
is.
Right, so come on then. This could be your soapbox. So they're making a fifth gear, but they're not making it with you. And I think that's a bit sacrilegious because you are fifth gear, Tim.
Yeah, I haven't actually put it on the internet. I probably will soon. But when this goes out, this could be the launch.
I'm going to put this out. This will go out for just ahead of the Revival weekend, so we can big up what you're doing at the Revival and everything. So you're not doing fifth gear.
Yeah, there's a new series of fifth gear being filmed now, and someone at Discovery UK decided that the show will be a better show without.
And that's the exact phrase that came back.
Yeah. We're moving on. We're changing the format.
You're a bit salty about this, aren't you?
Well, the format's the same. I mean, there's nothing changing in the sort of items they're doing are exactly the same, but someone there doesn't like me.
Do you think you were exciting the female audience too much?
I don't know. Ageist, obviously. It's ageist. I don't, but people get into the powerful positions and you have to go with the flow and you can't fight it.
Have you pissed someone off?
Don't know. I've never met the person that's decided they don't like me. I've never met, don't even know
the
name.
Yeah, but I've pissed a lot of people off I've never met.
Yeah, no.
On the internet.
I might have pissed them off somewhere. But anyway, but although that is very sad, because I was pivotal, I created Fifth Gear. So that makes it even sadder, really. It's a program I created.
But you've got something else you do.
Yeah, so fortunately it means I'd be doing more on Love Cars. So Love Cars is a YouTube show which I do with Paul Woodward and we have a lot of fun mucking about. I really enjoy doing it. It's light and casual. He's also got a TV show he's trying to work on at the moment, so I could be back on TV. But Love Cars show. So expand doing more of that. We've got nice stories to come out. To Cohen's, when Fifth Gear comes out, we've got some rather nice tiff on Love Cars stories to come out.
You're so impish. Many of you won't know Tiff. You'll know who he is, but you won't know him as a person. What you see is what you get. It's not difficult getting him to talk about any subject. But what you need to know, that you probably don't know, is that he's getting on a bit. How old are you now?
Oh, 67.
So he's 67 years old, right? And now a lot of racing drivers or professional drivers, they do reach a point, don't they, Sam, where they drop off. They can't quite do it.
Yeah, apparently it happens about down. 67.
Yeah. but what you need to know is that Tiff is still absolutely on the money with the car control game. So a few years ago, I don't know, some of you might have seen a film that I did with Neil and Tiff and Marino Franchitti. We went to Portimao circuit and we were driving LaFerrari, the three hypercars of the time, the LaFerrari, the 918 and the P110. I said to Tiff, we can't do this without you, you've got to get you along. It's just going to be a week drinking wine, cocking about in other people's cars. Turned out to be quite good fun. And Tiff just turns up with a bit of a hangover from being at Twickenham the night before.
Yeah,
I think
well, that's true.
And
yeah.
he jumps straight in a LaFerrari and just is fully sideways for a whole lap straight away. He's absolutely got it. And he'll blush with this. There's a handful of people that I really would rate to get in a car, wring its neck, to make it look right for the camera and to make noises and talk and entertain people at the same time. And he's still on that list. And he shouldn't be at his age. He shouldn't be.
And one thing I will say to you,
you utter hypocrite, is that you're always on Twitter saying that racing drivers, when they get to a certain age, should just sod off and let the young ones
through. Grand Prix drivers, yes, yeah. Correct.
And I think TV presenters should as well. You're too good at this age.
Sodded off. Now I've been sodded off by someone else. So that an opportunity is arising now. Fifth gear. If you're a young presenter thinking there's a chance there, obviously Discovery UK are looking for new talent.
What's the
But that was a great... I should thank you really for inviting me on that film because that was absolutely epic. It was a shame because one of the cars let us down at the end of the day. We couldn't do the extra sliding shots.
We can't say which one it was. Yeah.
However, I do want to pick you up right now because you and Marino piked out of the final answer. You were the one that said, right, you've got to pick one car, which is it. So I went first and I was honest and true, knowing that the other two were going to follow and said the Ferrari. Marino goes next. Oh, I'd have to have all three. Well, I suppose if you got access to his father-in-law's museum, you probably could have all three. And then I thought, okay, Marino's piked out. At least Harris will come up with a definitive answer of which one.
Which
I'll have the one I last drove. Which nobody could remember which one he last drove, so nobody knew actually he was referring
to. Deliberately mauve. It was yeah.
But
I now...
And what was the so which one now, would you prefer of those three?
P1 is the one I'd have.
Okay.
I think time's been very kind to the P1. It just looks amazing. Every time
I see
one...
whistling turbo. The LaFerrari was just...
How can you not take a LaFerrari over
I'd have the P1. I mean, that LaFerrari was sensational. I was following, and I was basically stuck up his exhaust pipes with him fully sideways coming out that last corner, just and the noise coming out the back of it, just thinking, you can buy one of these as a civilian. You need to be very rich, but you should need a special license to drive it, because they're so fast, aren't they?
Well, I've got a theory. I wrote a column about this years ago, that we're getting too much power into road cars and then we should actually self-limit ourselves. I've got this brilliant idea. You see, Beatty Chiron, one day a 19-year-old from some country wherever is going to plough into a bus lane full of pedestrians.
Well, it's all over for all of us, won't it?
We all have. So I came up with this brilliant idea that we should self-legislate. Because I get bored with every new Porsche 911. You wear a Porsche 911s or a sports car from Germany. You might know what they are. So every new one comes out has to have 35 more horsepower. It's going on and on and on. So if we self-register, so we said a supercar, maximum 700 horsepower, a touring a GT car, 500, a sports saloon, 400, front-wheel drive car, 250, right? So every new Porsche 911 that comes out with the regulation 600 horsepower and does another 5 miles to the gallon. We look greener.
Yeah.
We still keep our supercars, because if you drive a McLaren F1 with 624 horsepower, whatever it is, without 10,000 computers on board... It's enough power for anyone on the public roads.
Well, I'm normally against this argument, partly because I feel that it, the moment you start to admit that that's a problem, it's the thin end of the wedge, and you give them you basically empower the people that want to stop us having fun.
Yeah.
But I do. I see it now. They're too. I don't know what
launching Lamborghinis into trees in 30 mile an hour speed.
And what's that all
about?
When I got a load of grief on social media from people by saying I thought that was wrong. But I'd
ban launch control.
Yeah,
ban launch control.
Yeah.
But reduce the power. We don't need, because when you get a Bugatti and you open the throttle, you don't have 1,500 horsepower. The computer's always a bit wet. You've got a bit of lock on. You can have 300 horsepower now. Yeah. You haven't got one at all.
That's the problem. There's such a safety net of gizmos to save all these drivers from themselves. And one day, the gizmos can't keep up with the situation.
They can turn them off. And one of the problems is, sooner or later, they'll say there's no off button.
But most manufacturers keep a little bit in there somewhere. AMG Mercs always seem to have a little bit lurking.
And they're quite clever. They look at the last input. So if your last input was a brake input, then the ESP will come back on, even if you've turned it off. But if you're doing a sideways shot and you just coast in, it'll give you everything. You know, it's quite a lot. It's the previous input they look at.
That McLaren spat me off. You know, I got a lot of trouble from McLaren for filming that and saying this is what happened. The MP412C, because it had no diff, did it? It had a sort of four-wheel braking.
Yeah.
And they told me after what happened, because I was power sliding out of a corner, and just I'm feathering off to regain the grip, to slowly reintroduce
something,
grip,
come back in, it break
it
a wheel.
It cut the torque. He said, "Oi, boy, we think you're about to crash." So the torque of the engine was just halved. So the rear tyre just gripped and it just spat me straight left.
So did you hit anything or just go off on the
rough? No, I even missed all those landing lights, but it could have been. I've moved the cameraman as well.
Let's go back in time, because what a lot of people who watch you on the internet now won't know is that you raced in Formula One. You qualified in Formula One.
I only ever wanted to be a racing driver. I raced the one race.
You did? Was it Monaco? You did?
No, didn't qualify at Monaco. But my greatest driving, I qualified.
Tell us about your F1 race. I want to hear it. I want to hear Tiff speak about driving an F1 car in an F1 race. Come on.
So Clay Regazzoni broke his back in Long Beach.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to American Forces Overseas on my little wireless in bed at home, because it was, you know, hours behind. I thought, blimmin' hell, this could be, you know, I've driven for Unipart before. You always think that as racing drivers. Someone's injured. It doesn't happen much these days, so the youngsters don't get
And that was the mindset, was it?
Up tomorrow morning. How soon do you phone?
You're not thinking, is Clay all right? You're thinking, I might get a drive.
He'd broken his back. Well, that's all right. He's alive. So you're straight away, your first. But then you think, how soon do you phone? You know, so, oh, gosh. So I phoned Unipart because I knew them. They were the sponsors. And then, oh, here's a chance. And then the team were looking for Mike Thackwell, was the young boy of the day, you know. They took him out to Zolder, in fact, to do the test. Because the Belgium, I thought it was Belgium, was Zolder and not Spa. But I drove out in my little Ford Capri, my 10-year-old 1600 Ford Capri. I drove out to Zolder and
stood
on the fence.
What level of Lothario were you in a Ford Capri?
It's good. Had a vinyl roof, had a brown vinyl, orange, like my crash helmet, good colour. So I drove out there, which Mike Thackwell
what
drove
year are we
for
now?
2 days, 1918.
Yep.
So he turned it down because he didn't like the car that much. It was a shitbox, you know, it was a back of the grid Grand Prix car.
What was it, an Ensign?
It was an Ensign, yeah. And in those days, you know, 30 cars you'd turn out for every Grand Prix, but only the fastest 24 got the grid. So anyway, so I'm not going to get that drive. And there was a Formula 2 race at Nürburgring. So I drove on to the Formula 2 race in my orange Capri. So I didn't have a drive at all at that stage. And I actually, bizarrely, did some laps for the guy. I had my helmet, wheel travel, nearly got a race in the Formula 2. But that didn't happen. Then the phone call came. I was like, you better get back home quick. So the little Capri flew back home. But I was offered the drive with the Ensign. I had half a day's testing at Donington. And then I was out qualifying at Zolder, you know, where you're only the fastest 24. So I qualified 23rd out of the 30, which is the same as Regazzoni had at Long Beach.
So, it was the so you were on the performance of the car?
But of course, it was a single teammate. Car team.
That, oh, it was a single car team.
That's the problem, yeah. So you were in a single... No, so Mo Nunn was saying... I said, it understeered this car. It's understeering a bit. Oh, Clay never said he did. Clay said it oversteered. Clay says it oversteered all the time. Clay. So I had this battle. He just wouldn't believe me, you know. And later, end of the year, the designer actually said what I'd told them would have cured their problems. Because over the famous crest before where Villeneuve that crash, the steering was locking up. It was tightening over the crest. And the car was understeering a lot. As I said, it was understeering. And when he thought back, what had happened was as soon as the monocoque, the chassis were old because they were aluminium tubs, once they got soft, the stiff new aluminium would grip and oversteer. But what was happening with mine, I had a soft used monocoque. And when it was twisting, which caused the understeer, it was tightening the steering rack. So if they'd listened to me at Zolder, they might have learned what the problem with their chassis.
Everyone should listen to Tiff. He can solve every problem. Third world,
I qualified and I sat on the back row of the grid of the Belgian Grand Prix. And there alongside me was Emerson bleeding Fittipaldi.
Really?
Could you see
Could you see his sideburns in his helmet?
You could. They're
coming out of his lid.
In front of me were Keke Rosberg, somebody. And I was there at the back row of the grid of the Belgian Grand Prix.
But at that moment, are you thinking, wow, I can't believe I'm here? Or are you thinking, I just want to race.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing, really. Because it all happened so... I actually sat on the back of the grid going, dum da da dum da da. I did. I literally... I didn't know what else to think. What did I think? So for 12 laps, I battled with Emerson Fittipaldi for the honour of being last in the 1980 Belgian Grand Prix, and the engine broke. Then we went out to Monaco. They gave me another shot at Monaco. But Monaco, only the fastest 20 got on the grid out of 30 cars. And I just made the... In those days, as is now, Monaco Formula 1 is on Thursday and Saturday. Right, Friday's always a day off. But in those days, the 1 hour practice on Thursday was qualifying, and the 1 hour on Saturday was qualifying. So you had an hour's qualifying just to do what you were in and out. And in the wet Monaco, this is my greatest achievement in life that nobody knows about because it didn't get anywhere. I was 19th in the rain around Monaco out of the 30. I was 0.003 millionths of a second behind Alain Prost and his Renault. So I was on the grid. I was 19th and on the grid on Thursday. So I all day Friday walking around, thunderstorms, rain, you know, kill. And then the Saturday, unfortunately, the warm-up, you had a one-hour untimed session each morning. I clipped the chicane curb, which then, and the chicane coming onto the seafront, you came out of the tunnel, right?
Yeah.
And you came, it was a central reservation with like 3-foot-tall concrete. And they just cut out a section of the 3-foot-tall concrete curb.
That's where you went through.
So you just went through a gap. Where there was no extra, it was just boom. And I just clipped with one of the rims and it broke a pickup point in the chassis. So for the afternoon qualifying in the dry, I had to go out in a completely fresh chassis, short wheelbase version, had to bed in brakes, ended up the skateboard at Sand in Vogue, all the brakes faded as you had to braking, you had to bed in pads in those days, you had to slow laps, bring in the heat slowly, overheat them, cool them. So that was, you know, time. So I didn't qualify for the 1980. In fact, I've ended up crashing into the swimming pool barriers trying to get the recalcitrant Ensign on the grid. But then I was sacked after that. They actually wanted... There was an American investor in the team, Jan Lammers, the very talented young Dutchman, who'd qualified fourth at Long Beach when Regazzoni had crashed, in the ATS, which is a shitbox.
See, I've watched that recently.
So he was the stunning kid. He was the boy. They were, even when I was at Zolder, the Belgian Grand Prix, there was little meetings here with Jan flipping Lammers were going on. I mean, that... They didn't believe me about the car. They thought Jan Lammers was faster. So he got the drive after Monaco, and he failed to qualify for the next 6 Grand Prix, not even in the 24. So it killed his career, but obviously that made me feel better that, you know, it wasn't me, it was a shitbox. But you don't get back in again.
You know, they're wonderful stories. I'm sure you've told them a few times because many people have asked you, but now I'm glad they're committed to our podcast. But joking aside, Do you look back and think, shit, I wish I'd had a better chance. I wish all these things had been different. Or do you think, I did a Formula One race and not many people can say
yeah,
that.
I think that. I'm always, you know, my glass is half full. Yeah. Obviously, looking back, I could have done so many things differently. You know, I mean, nowadays, you know, a racing driver, you can't have sex before the race. You can't drink at all. You have to go to the gym. You have to do to a simulator
for a week.
You want to come
to Garage 59 for a race weekend,
yeah,
mate.
We're simulator.
Not, we don't do much of that.
Got to check which way I look. You've got to have a physical trainer, someone to paint your crash helmet for you. You got to have, you know, masseurs in the truck. This is for a, you know, Formula 4 race.
Yeah.
So I think, wait, can you swear on this podcast?
Yes, you can,
or not?
Yeah.
Freaking
yeah.
hell. If I'd had all of that, instead of being on pole position and winning a race by a second, I'd have fucking won those races by a lap. If I had all that. And wait, we, in Formula Ford in 1970s, we never wondered why the little bloke, we always had a bent engine when the little blokes overtook you on the street. Nobody thought that about weight. It's bizarre now when you think how obsessive we are. So big blokes, we're all just accused of having bent engines. So I would have obviously got on better knowing what I did.
But you
now.
Went on sports cars.
Yeah, I'd had Group C for 10 years. I was lucky to hit the Group C. When the Formula One failed, just happened to be the beginning of Group C sports cars. So I did 14 Le Mans 24-hour races. No, absolutely wonderful.
Best finish was?
A third with a private Porsche. In fact, the top six were all factory cars in 1990 when we finished third. So it was we only beat by the two silk-cut Jaguars, and behind us was the factory Porsche.
So you've got a pot. You've actually got... You have
yeah,
got
oh, bits and pots from Le Mans. So, yeah, you know, I would have done better if I'd known what I know now, but no. I mean, I don't actually believe I was a Clark or a Senna or a Schumacher. I now know, you know, that I wasn't a brilliant, naturally talented. But, you know, we look at the Damon Hills or Gray's dad, Graham. Well, there's a lot of racing drivers who can still get the same lap time without the natural talent. You know, driving fast isn't just the natural, brilliant talent. You've got to ally it to hard work and engineering and getting a car to work for you. Alan
it depends
Prost,
which era you're racing in as well, because, you know, as Vettel's proved, yeah. you know, with a blown diffuser, he was the man. But take yeah. his blown diffuser away, yeah. you know, he just suited that particular, his driving style and approach suited that car, didn't it? When they went, he was nowhere. Well, not nowhere, but he wasn't the same item, was he?
Yeah, and I had a brilliant time. And I'm still racing. I'm still racing at Goodwood. You know, 60 years after I climbed up a bank. The bank we're looking at now, out of there, coming out of the chicane. I climbed up as about a four-year-old when my dad brought
and
me here.
I bet you were the noisiest, loudest. I mean, I'm accused
I've
of being
never
loud,
been
but
quiet
you're
in
different
my life.
Gravy.
I was quiet for the first time in my life. I just stood there and watched these loud, noisy
smells.
I want this. I want this.
Do you ever fall down a YouTube hole watching Formula One Grand Prix footage yes, of yourself?
Yes, badly. Not myself. It's not there. You know, it's about those
it
one little clip.
And this week, I stayed up till 1 a.m.
He's broken down.
That is there.
That's about it.
The race was it Race of Champions? Brands Hatch?
Oh, no, I was in that Aurora. That was, yeah. yeah
Murray Walker commentating. Yeah. Got Andretti fighting
I was in my
louder.
Durex car. That is a real, that's not a rude word. I was in my Durex. That was the Aurora. So that wasn't Grand Prix.
Did you get free National French letters?
Yes.
Did you?
The great thing with all the girls when I was racing, they used to the Marlborough girls were there, so I'd get free fags and I'd give them free condoms. It was a good exchange, I thought. But I think the other thing about myself, I am the spectator from the terraces that became a Grand Prix driver, because I clung to these fences around Goodwood for 10 years, you know, and watched Jim Clark, Stirling Moss dreaming of being a racing driver, and then I, you know, won that kind of magazine competition. So I'm literally the kid off the terraces that became a racing driver dreaming. Because nowadays in all sports, it's hardly ever the enthusiasts, you know, you start karting. I mean, none of the Grand Prix grid now would have stood on a fence and watched a Formula One race or watched any racing probably in their entire lives.
I think that's a sad and probably fair statement.
I'm a fan. I'm a racing fan.
Given that you were growing up watching that period of racing where drifty was the necessary and default style, did that inform your style? Have you always been this sort of drift king? Or
yeah,
you
good. It's got to look good.
Because there was, you know, the Villeneuve style, wasn't there? And then everybody else was a bit tidier.
It has to look like you're on the limit, which brings us to track limits, which obviously, as you
we'll do that in a minute. Jesus Christ, but we'll do that in a minute.
I think if nobody ever spins in a day's racing, if the public never understand that you are near the edge of something, then there's no excitement
there. We discussed this on the previous podcast. This is the right circuit to discuss this.
Exactly.
If you're stood on the bank at Madwick and you watch an E-Type come through, you just see the language of the car. You know it's on the limit.
It might crash any second.
It's sliding around. But you could deploy just as much skill in a modern GT3 car, but they got no idea. Because the moment you get the thing moving around, the tyre goes off and you're done.
Yep.
And I think... I look at all forms of motorsport that really grab me visually have slip angle. Trophy trucks, rally driving, all that stuff. It really grabs me more because And I quite like to see what the driver's doing. I would put Perspex, everything on the side of the car so you can see what's going on inside.
But I really admire what you guys do with your TV drifty stuff, because in the few occasions that I've had to do, I find it really hard to switch off my sort of default racing driver setting of keeping everything straight
and theoretically quick.
And I can't dial into the drifty stuff.
I wanted to ask Tiff about that, because I think it's a bit like being a hockey player and trying to play golf. Anyone that does those two, there's very few people that do that, will understand. If you're a hockey player, it's very difficult to play golf because you've got so much bottom hand. It completely corrupts your golf swing. And in the same way, I find that if I've been filming for the telly and I've just spent 4 days ripping tyres to bits, going sideways, I have to consciously, when I get in a race car at the weekend, a modern racing car, GT3 car, I'm terrible for the first 10 minutes. My teammates say I'm terrible all weekend. but you really do. Because what happens is, that for me, I think we've all got a sensor right on the end of your coccyx, right? That's your key drift sensor. That's where the gyro is placed. And a great racing driver, the moment that gyro senses slip angle, a bolt goes up your back and your brain goes right back off it.
Whereas
mine and his, I think, are corrupted. And I'm not saying anything about your ass, Tiff. But when I'm in drifty mode, if I feel that sign, I grin and I go, fuck it, power. Let's get there.
We're on the limit. Yeah. We're getting there now.
But that's not fast. It's not fast. And the two are not...
That's the thing.
Not mutually.
Well, it still is fast with E-types. It still is fast with the older cars.
But not modern cars.
No.
And when I get that signal, my instant reaction is do whatever I need to do on the throttle and the steering to bring the car straight again.
Yeah.
So I find it really hard to dial out of that.
But these old cars, they deal in delicate slip angles. They're small. If you're working 10 to 2 around there, 2:45, then you're about right. But if you're going beyond that, you're going slowly and you're taking stuff out the rear tyre. So I think it's just not overreacting to that initial signal and going with the slide, isn't it? Rather than being a yobbo.
But how did you, for the first time you ever drove a historic race car here at Goodwood? I mean, I don't know about you. Mine was a lightweight E-type and I thought it was going to throw me off and I nearly sort of stood down from the seat. I thought there's not a chance in hell I'm going to get this thing across the line without shunting it. But you get used to it.
Yeah, I didn't. I'd spent so much time looking out the side window of stuff. I have to say, it didn't worry me because I remember it was the Lister coupe that comes out every year. Just still my favourite old racing car. You've driven it.
I've driven the coupe. But I've driven
it's
Lister.
It's just
Lister,
mega. I just thought this is. I have to say, I just thought, why wasn't I doing this before? This is the kind of racing I want to be involved in. Nice slip angles, pretty delicate braking areas and just sliding cars around and feeling the move underneath you and seeing the crowd's response to a car that's properly, that looks like it's alive on
and
four
course,
wheels.
You know, we didn't bang into each other in those days either. That's the other difference because, you know, we were busy trying to not have an accident on our own.
Well, they do here, don't they, Tiff?
Well, I know. Sometimes, the Duke.
Richmond.
Has he had words with you? Have you been told off or not?
Of course not. I'm a good boy.
Have you, like Chris, made it to the public TV wall of shame in the driver's briefing videos?
Yeah, there's good footage.
I don't think I've done nothing wrong.
I think if you had done, we'd be shouting about it.
But going back to modern racing, that's why, you know, because they are so controlled, which is why we get more body banging and diving up the insides. The excitement of modern racing is almost car-to-car impact rather than drifting visible. So the entertainment now for a modern crowd isn't a car on its own on the edge. I would say this, that a Formula is only exciting if watching one car go through corner on its own.
Very good point.
Is exciting. But none also of the modern stuff is. Like the touring cars, those horrible TCR things. Only excitement is them hitting each other.
But there's also a disconnect with television and the way that television saps speed and energy from the racing car. I never forget the first time. I never used to go and watch Formula One races as a kid because my parents weren't into the sport at all. They kept me away from it because they didn't want me to get too into it. But I only ever watched them on telly. And I remember the first time I ever watched an F1 car was probably 97, 98, Silverstone, when they did that mid-season tyre test. I went to Beckett's Maggots and stood on the bank there and watched someone come through flat chat. I could not believe it. The speed and the energy and the noise was just absolutely captivating.
The glowing brake discs there.
It was just so fast.
Was that going into the modern Beckett's Bypass?
No, that you was were. Yeah, going into the modern Beckett. So you
I
come out
Beckett's
cops.
Bypass. Yeah,
yeah, in there. Yeah.
Have you not seen that? Because that's remind you were that kid. Maybe have you seen the motorbike one with a little 4-year-old kid that's been around on social media?
Yeah, yeah.
And a motorbike goes by, and the kid just goes.
But I just couldn't.
Have you seen that? It's the best clip to show what excitement should be.
Yeah, I love it. But I just couldn't. I was probably about
25 at the time, but I just couldn't believe how much faster it looked in real life. Yeah. And I got a much better sense of what these gladiators were able to do. And having subsequently driven a couple of Formula One cars, one thing I'm not, you know, it's very easy to be sniffy about the, you know, the ones at the very back of the grid. It was always the Minardis in my Peugeot, wasn't it? You know, the couple of Minardis, you just thought they were a bunch of knobbers. And you were fairly convinced that you, in your Peugeot 106 XSI, could take care of them because they're crap. But anyone... anyone that can just not crash a Formula One car is a hero.
Yeah, they're good. They're good drivers. Well, there's no rubbish. A lot. Stroll gets a lot of stick, but he's still a very, very good. He's not brilliant, you know, but he's good.
Exactly. You know, there's no visibility in those cars, and they race wheel to wheel with. These things have got 1,000 horsepower now. I mean, they're not messing about, are they?
No.
So I do have utmost respect for anyone that can get in a Formula One car and not just stick it straight in the barriers, frankly.
It's why, you know, taking the spectators so far away at these modern tracks is the other problem. Like you say, you were excited because you were close to that speed. And that's one of the few places on Silverstone that you can go to, but the actual fence is quite close to the cars.
So maybe all spectator points should be on the inside of the circuit and the pits should be on the outside of the circuit.
Well, you could possibly, but
why not? That would work.
But if you got close, I always think if I had spectators, like in the braking zone, you could be over the top of the cars. They could have their run off straight ahead, but you can actually take some stands you could take much closer in certain areas.
Well, this is a good. So Tiff Nadell's circuit design would have spectator areas over braking zones. How would you deal with track limits?
Ah, I don't know. It's a big. The problem is you have to have a limit because the whole skill of a racer driver, the ultimate skill is to be very fast, but inch, millimetre perfect. Ayrton Senna, all his onboards of Monaco or Imola I've seen and the huge curbs, and he just nailed every lap, you know.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And nowadays you watch a series of Formula One cars come out of the first corner at Hockenheim, for example. And there's one on the left and one in the middle and one over there. But they all end up doing the same speed on the next straight. So nobody's lost out. So you can now hooligan around a track. So the average driver that doesn't have the ultimate skill is so much closer to the brilliant driver. So we've got this gap that's closing and closing and closing. So the only way you can reward the really talented driver is to somehow give him tighter limits. Now, if we don't want to be injured, which is obviously why we have safe limits and runoff, then we have to have runoff. But then, if the runoff isn't policed somehow, either by these time penalties, which people hate, or, you know, I think a very slippery bit of AstroTurf, so as soon as you're off the track, you have to somehow make people back off. They have to lose time.
If there's enough technology in the cars to control anything. So if you have the ability to have a DRS system that can work within, if you get within 1 second of the car in front, why couldn't you have a sensor that said, right, you were outside the track limits, you lose 15 horsepower for the next lap?
Another way. Slow.
So I think that I agree there should be a penalty.
You just have to lift it. It has to make you slow. So you've lost your time by going off the road. You know?
It sounds in principle when you're sitting around a table talking about it to be the armchair expert. So easy to police this and work out a solution. But when you get to a race meeting, you see the mayhem that goes on and the way the circuits have been designed. And it has to be said, the priority of safety. It's a real problem.
But as soon as it's wet, they stay within the track. If you see the AstroTurf, if you put a wheel on the AstroTurf, they spin. But it should be in the drive.
I love the way old Charles Leclerc was moaning about the last corner being too slippery.
Yeah. It's like, perfect.
The runoff area being too slippery. It's like, well,
it shouldn't be out there, really.
It's not high-speed grass.
You've been out there a few times, I'm sure you have as well. Where's the one place where no one takes the mickey on track limits? The Nürburgring. When you go on to the Nordschleife, you don't hear drivers going, I'm being pinged for track limits, because if you go out there, you kill yourself.
Spa has been ruined to me. I mean, Spa was just the most magical circuit, and doing Eau Rouge in a Group C car with walls each side of you.
Still feels quite grown up now.
Do you remember coming through the old bus stop chicane where you had to launch it over the curbs and you're desperately trying to keep it out of the arm car on the right? Oh, it was
Blanchimont.
I only did it
once. Oh, that was scary, Blanchimont. Because it had a horrible curb on the exit. Yeah. If you just ran that curb, it would just turn you sharp left. I mean, you'd virtually flat out in a group, see 170 miles an hour. So the limit was there. Club Corner, which I write in my book, still available on Amazon, by the way, Tiff Gear, brilliant.
Tiff Gear.
The Club Corner at Silverstone is really fast. It had the most gnarly curbs. It wasn't consistent, like an FIA-designed curb. And you knew if you were an inch not getting the curb, you were 2 miles an hour slow for the long run up to Abbey. But if you were an inch faster and hit that bloody gnarly curb, it would just grab you and pitch you, and the wall was then 10 feet to your left.
I will say, so you had that...
edge to build up.
There are arguments against the way the circuits are designed and the way they run. There are arguments about the cars being too easy to drive, which you could spend hours on. But I still believe in one thing, that there's always one bloke or woman who's faster than all the others. I just think there are one, and I think whatever you give them, whatever technology they've got at the time, whether they've got paddles or gear levers or two pedals or three pedals or wide circuits or thin circuits, dangerous circuits, safe circuits, they tend to be the quickest. Yeah. I do believe that Lewis...
It's just the gap is so small now, it's 0.2.
I know.
Whereas in Jim Clark's day, he could be 2 seconds quicker than a very, very good
Lewis is the man at the moment.
Whichever era
he was in, he was going to be...
Now, we've got great Grand Prix racing coming. I mean, we don't know how changed the new car is going to be in 2021, but I mean, the fantastic prospect of Leclerc and Verstappen and Norris and Williams, our other British driver.
George Russell.
Russell, you know, all coming on. I mean, it's the most fantastic...
It's going to be fantastic. I don't know, the one aspect of racing cars that I would... I'd love to see manual gearboxes. And when you watch onboards of Senna going round, half the lap is on one-handed.
Yeah,
just the skill to coordinate all that.
On another YouTube hole I fell down the other night, there was onboard from different cars in the same Grand Prix from the early 90s, you know, Piquet's Benetton, but with a manual gearbox. And then it would cut to sort of Mansell with semi-automatic paddles. And the difference was you really felt for Piquet, because what a job he had to do wrestling this thing through.
Well, you'd see that with a handle plastered up in a race, wouldn't
I had that at Monaco, just in the qualifying, you know, because so many gear changes. But I mean, it's also, you watch them driving now, we had to do all our gear changing before you turned in, because the steering was so heavy, you couldn't take a hand off the wheel to change your gear. So you had to select your gear before the corner. And when you're coming, you can't change up halfway out of the corner.
Yeah.
So I would quite like in Formula One to actually cut them down to four gears. Because now you see them coming down and they're turning in, all the Formula 3s, Formula 2s, they're all the same. The driver's turning, bim, bim, little left hand, bim. And as they're accelerating out, they just change up.
Well, everything's in those last 30 yards now, isn't it?
Well, the braking zone has shifted forward. It's in the braking zone.
You need to
no longer
increase
straight.
The braking zone. Because you couldn't now have a manual gearbox, because you can't, unless you had an H pattern, so you change straight from fourth to second.
Yep.
They had the sequential for
a bit, they did,
The problem was with the end of the braking got so good, they couldn't go down six punches in the braking length. So that's why sequentials got kicked out and the paddles were the next obvious option. But if you only had four gears, you could do bit. You could brake and change.
But also in endurance racing, it's how quickly the transmission as being the main problem for an endurance race just disappeared. I've not been doing it that long, but in the 20 years I've been racing cars, you know, when I first did long distance racing, it was, you know, you sat down and you just talked about how you'd nurse the transmission.
Declutched at Le Mans.
You treated it like your third testicle, didn't you? It was this thing that was delicate and to be looked after. Now, we don't even think about the gearbox. It's just this thing that gets you up through the revs. You don't even think about the bloody thing.
And as much as I hated fully automatic gearboxes in Formula One, what, a decade or so ago now, you may as well just reintroduce that, because the guys ping down through seven or so
makes
gears
no
with
no,
one
it's
finger.
Pre-select, didn't
you don't see
one.
It.
You know, that pre-selecting system about 10 years, because then we just press two. It would go to two automatically. A bit like slipper clutches in motorbikes, which I don't like, and then even the Valentino Rossi doesn't like them. You don't hear the blip blip on the way down now, do you? The bike boys just kick the thing down.
Well, on the road bikes, it's the same now. They've got blippers on the way down, haven't they?
Yeah. Can you literally just kick it and then it'll change down when it's ready for
it? My Ducati, as long as you're above 5,000 RPM, it's flat on the way up and the way down. You don't have to blip it on the way down, which is good for me because I'm not that skillful at that. I'm sure you're very good at it, aren't you? On the way.
I was like, every time I look at little, you know, when I do a test, I look at an old test, and I hear, I remember, that's me heeling and towing. That noise you're hearing, I've created that sound in order that my gear change is smooth.
That's what I can't stand about modern road cars, where all of that is automated, and you've got this ridiculously
the auto blip on the downshift is so good.
Nissan was the first. I remember I did
370Z.
And I was out, I did a piece down Reams, you know, and I said, Mike Hawthorne didn't have to do this, you know, I'm changing gear as good as Mike Hawthorne. And it was
so disappointing. I thought, I've spent 15 years perfecting this. I used to go out at night and not admit to people I was learning how to heel and toe, and there's a computer that's better at it than me. Bugger off. Hey, let's talk a bit briefly about Tiff on two wheels, because you do ride a bike now and again, don't you?
Yeah, I haven't borrowed one for a couple of years now. Whenever I can, I manufacture and bump into and...
What's Tiff like on two wheels? Are you an idiot, or are you...
Yes, yeah, that's why I give them back. I won't put all the clothing on. I mean, I'm jeans. I've got a little leather jacket. I wear that. When you start, you know, doing 90 miles an hour in second gear, 16,000 revs.
They've got crazy now. They're so
I know,
far.
But they're so exciting. But it's freedom. And I almost don't want to wear a crash helmet. I see them in America on their Harleys with no crash helmets on. That's what bikes. I just jump on T-shirt, jeans, you know. And safety sports, so many things. It makes you feel guilty. You've got to wear all the clobber. But I love bikes.
So outside, the public knows you as the racing driver face of television, but there's lots of other stuff you enjoy. And your social media, you give us a little window into it.
Huge sports
fan. It's a lovely story about football. You wanted something to do with your boys, didn't you? So you thought, let's all go to the football together.
Well, they asked me, and I thought, what do I go football match for? You know, I like all sports. I mean, I'm a fan of every sport apart from, I think, ice hockey and basketball. They're the only two sports that bore me. And they said, go to football. Anyway, so I got some tickets off of Matt Letizia, actually. I was met in Southampton. But the first time I walked down to the ground with my two sons in their red and white clean scarves, I thought, well, this is what dads should do. And it's been brilliant for the Nidell family, because we go to away games, we stand in with all the loony fans singing the songs. And of course, when they went off to university, you know, most parents say once your kids get, you don't see them for 3 months at the end of term. Yeah, they come back every 2 weeks, the home games. So it's been nice that it's bonded the family. But, you know, I was in Fulham last night. You know, I was up there last night cheering on them.
Your eyes look a little bit.
Yeah, I was a bit tired. We're coming back. Had a couple of beers. But, I mean, and in 90 minutes, the point is, in 90 minutes, I go through joy, terror, annoyance, rage, you know, disappointment.
So it's like filming Top Gear.
But in 90 minutes, there's so much excitement. And we actually, obviously, I think any sport, you have to love a car. So I love NASCAR and stuff. And when Montoya went over and started a NASCAR, the 42 car.
Yeah.
So we followed the 42. That's a big thing in America. You've got the 42, you follow your 88, you follow your 24. And of course, now they've got this great kid in Larson, who's in the 42. So there's only one son's a big NASCAR fan. So we sit and watch the NASCAR, and where's the 42? And you've got it. Because in NASCAR, you can be two laps down, you know, and 43rd on the leaderboard. Still, and you can win the flipping race, you know, if you get the cautions come in the right time and you get your laps back. And it's an awesome sport. And I did a NASCAR for Top Gear, I think it was, way back in the 80s. I went around Charlotte. And the technicality of these things, yeah, they're all poo-pooed.
Did you do one of those ASCAR races?
Yeah. I did the ASCAR demo run when the engines were too bad.
So I did one of the races.
I did a demo race.
Blew my mind. It was so difficult. The technique of the car was, the setup was unbelievable. I don't know about you, I did one lap and thought, I've got massive respect for these guys.
You roll off, because they have a free diff on deceleration. So if you snap off, it'll spin.
Wow.
So you have to be, so you're going down the straight holding it, right,
it wants,
because
to go
it
left.
Wants to go left. Yeah. And then as you get to the goal, you have to roll out of it, and then you slowly release the grip, and in it goes.
And you're thinking, your brain is completely overloaded with all this new stuff, and then you've got this voice in your ear going, there's a bloke to your left and a bloke to your right. Well, I can't see him, can I?
It's a great sport. I mean, it's another sport, another entertainment. I've got respect for them when I did the Daytona 24 Hours back in 82 or something. I did the Daytona 24 Hours the first time, and the Pepsi Challenger, and Nimrod Aston Martin, and my teammates were Darrell Waltrip and AJ Foyt.
Were they?
Yeah. Oh, what a
That's
mega
cool.
weekend.
That is really.
And it was
cool.
The first. It was the last race when they didn't have a bus stop chicane in the back chute. So I was going round one and two, and then I'm going down the wall at 200 miles an hour, and then three and four are looming up, and it took me about four laps before I could believe it would go around flat. You know, whoa, up you go. most amazing sensation anyway. But in that race in those days, there were like 80 starters and there were like little sedans, Toyota
Sleekers.
You've not
been to Daytona. It's not as big as you think it is when you get there, is it?
I know, it's all floodlit now. It's all dark in those days. We'd have, you'd have, you know, NASCAR lookalikes all welded doors and you have Group C sports cars. Everything was thrown in Porsche 935s. Now that must really get you excited. Cool. Yeah, sorry.
It'd also grab your attention driving it around there as well, I think.
But I'd follow these NASCAR lookalike cars round the banking on opposite lot. You know, I'm fairly glued thinking, gosh, I'm going fast. And I catch these kids up, you know, fighting it up the banking on opposite lock.
And, thinking, and it's steep banking at Daytona as well. So it's really steep.
So I've got huge respect for the oval races, you know, and I love watching
them. And I'm obviously now trying to paint a picture of the Tiffany outside of cars, and you've gone straight back to cars.
golf, cricket. Golf. What a test. We are. You tweet for cricket as well. This year we've been spoiled with the two of the most amazing.
Sunday, so we're recording this just after that remarkable victory on Sunday.
Which, first the World Cup, and then this, the two.
But I'm a test match fan, and I have to say, do you remember that? I tell you what, do you remember the one thing we did many years ago? We went to the Nürburgring with Jaguar, and you had to drive.
I've got the bat. It gave me a bat. It was my birthday, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was your birthday. So you again turned up with a hangover as you normally do.
Yeah, that's true.
And we had to drive these cricket stars around the Nürburgring. And the night before, we went for a meal, and a few of them had a bit too much to drink. In fact, most of them did. They were all, so we had a mixture of the current England cricket team, sort of Andersons, Broads, that lot. And then we had Kevin Keegan and Ian Botham. But they got absolutely hammered the night before, and we had to take them out and drive them. I took Alistair Cook round, and I went as fast as I dared, and it was wet in an XKR, the thing bloody oversteered in the kink on the Tiergarten, and I thought, I'm going to be in the papers for this. And he had no idea. Afterwards, he went, that looked a bit lively. He went, nah, it always does that. Got out and went around the corner and went, oh! But he took Kevin Keegan out, and he come out of the pits. Keegan's what a lovely man to start with. He was just a legend. He was more than you expected, just a great lad. Black suit. He just looked like he'd walked off a football field in 1986. He goes out with Tiff. They go down out of the public entrance into the dip at Tiergarten. And I come on a lap, and there's just this car by the side of the road. And Keegan's over the barrier, hewing into the scenery. And it was for some team. Oh, it was going to go on fifth gear or something, wasn't it?
It was a fifth gear story.
And he wouldn't let it. He said respectfully, I'd rather not be on the telly chundering.
How long did he last?
It wasn't. Well, it was half a lap. Or half a lap.
Yeah. Oh, no, you didn't even make it.
I don't know all the names. I'm not, you know.
But if you don't know what to expect, if you've not been to the Nordschleife before, or you're not used to the car, first time I ever
and
went
you
around.
And you drank four bottles of red the night before.
Yeah, I mean, that's the worst. We were with a historic racing friend of ours, who I'm sure you guys know, Simon Diffie, in his old BMW estate years and years ago, and had never been around. And far more of us piled into this thing than there were seats in the car, let alone seat belts. And he was lit sideways everywhere. And I seriously had a word with myself. It was a sort of, I would rather walk however many miles back to the beginning it is than complete this lap. Because I know how many miles are ahead. But I don't think I can do another corner because I was that scared. But he drove brilliantly. And of course, you just bite your lip.
A lot of drivers get nausea there in the gloaming. So as the sun's coming down and the light is fading in the 24-hour race, quite often a lot of drivers get nauseous. And one of my teammates, and if you're listening to this, Guy Spur, great lad, he was we were in a cup car. I don't know what this was, say 10, 12 years ago. And Guy got nauseous, and he radioed in and said, I've got to come in, I'm going to be sick. And he chundered on his in-lap. Ooh. He's coming in, so he chundered. So we got out of the car. They threw me in. So there's chunder everywhere. Oh, it's like, okay, fair enough. It's just a bit of chunder, isn't it? I'm not too shy. It stank a bit, but then I don't smell too good myself, do I? So I got in, plugged in and everything. In those days, you just got, radios were pretty good, drink spot and everything. And I thought, okay, get going. So I'm out the pits. The team's on the radio going, get on with it, because we've lost a load of time. And that doesn't, basically an extra stop, we're not going to get back. And I thought, after about 10 minutes, I'll have a drink, press the button. Of course, he chundered down the tube and it fired a load of guys' chunder into my mouth. And I then chundered over myself. So it was just It's just vomit everywhere.
Not a race you remember with any great joy.
Well, we didn't. I don't think we finished that one.
I never did that race. I never raced at Nürburgring.
Why have you not? It's literally made for you because you would just be there.
You have to qualify, don't you?
You'd be having a massive track limits wank off if you went there. You'd love it.
I've never raced there either. I'd love to. Let's go and do the qualifying races in a cheap little Clio.
Because it's a bit, if you're in the same pad car, overtaking is limited until you get to the straights.
You do have to be a bit careful, but you can overtake. And I'd say it's gone a bit the other way, that the young GT3 drivers, they've calmed them down now, but for a bit they just approached it like it was Rickard.
Went for every gap.
And you couldn't do that.
And the barriers.
And then when you just have massive shunts, and big multiple car shunts. Mm. It's still, you can persuade yourself that it's overrated and that it's spoken about too much and it's become too popular, the cult has grown too wide, and then you get there, you haven't been there for a while, and you do one lap and you go, this is the balls.
I do get bored with these Nürburgring. Someone was tweeting about, oh, watch this, some electric Porsche.
Oh, I did that. I tweeted that. It was you. I think you came back and just went, you just tweeted not interested or something.
Yeah.
I'm so
bored with Nürburgring. I mean, even, you know, I understand you might have driven this electric thing.
I haven't driven a Taycan yet.
No, this thing that went up.
Oh, the IDR thing. Yeah, I've driven that. Yeah.
And I don't get excited about land speed records, even when, you know, I was young with Blue Bike, and I don't get excited about any record that's not within a class of some sort of rules and regulations.
You're very consistent on this. You're a consistent curmudgeon on this.
Yes.
Because
that thing up. I mean, if you spend £10 billion, yeah, but don't to you try quite and like, not be embarrassed
you
about
quite
your
like the idea
diesel
of just
gate scandal
an ultimate for the sake of an ultimate that's testing a piece of technology. That's what it's doing.
Because then someone could ultimate your ultimate.
Well, why not? That's Can-Am, isn't it?
Have you ever done Can-Am and then blew out because Porsche came with a steamroller and
destroyed
Can-Am?
Oh, it's always Porsche's fault, isn't it, Tiff?
Yeah, now you make me think of it. And this is Volkswagen anyway, isn't it? Tried to make up for their diesel gate. So they come up, they spend £20 billion. They go out and beat a few Yanks with V8s in a home built in a garage record. And it's just meaningless, completely meaningless. So what? And then they take a Porsche to the Spa and say, we're quicker than the Formula One car. Well, if you went back with a Formula One car and took 200 kilos off it and put special tyres on it and wound it, we'd beat your lap record, which isn't a record at all. It's just a time on a bit of paper, which is meaningless.
The Porsche thing was mega. Don't get excited just to see something off the leash, just something outrageously quick. No?
No.
Look at
right. I like to see something that's on the limit.
I'll tell you what.
Pike's Peak electric thing, if you watch it, he just accelerates. And then he breaks and he goes out of the corner. There's no
It would
sliding.
Be a very, very different story if that Spa lap had Tiff written down the side of the car and a certain colour crash helmet. Then it would be the greatest single achievement by a human being, wouldn't it?
I did that stupid speed record around the bowl, haven't I? And the McLaren, I still hold the fastest production.
That came
comic
up
relief.
On the Andrew Frankel podcast. That came up because Andrew did 172.
Comic
he did 190
relief.
Or something.
I know, it was ridiculous and he'd kill myself for comic relief.
Why did you do that?
How comic relief, Top Gear made me do it.
How long did the front tyre last?
They bullied me. I was bullied by Top Gear.
Well, there you go. That's two.
Yeah, not the first one.
So can you tell me about the front tyre? What it must have lasted a lap at that speed.
Well, because I knew tyres were the issue. So we had all the time. I said,
no flies on you, Tiff.
No. But it was freezing cold, crosswind, horrible day. So I did three laps and came in. When they needled the tyres, they were only like 50 degrees. It was nothing wrong with it. But of course, you've got to do 2 miles slowing down to get to the needles to check your tyre temperature on a freezing cold bit of tarmac. So we didn't really, it was all a bit iffy. Then this one lap when I just tried to do, I was doing 200 miles an hour, I was trying to go 200 miles an hour average.
That's all of, it. What were you thinking?
I know, but rusty Millbrook guardrail.
I mean, you'd have ended up in Bedford.
But all of a sudden, the rear started walking, you know, and then, of course, you can't back off too quick because you know
then you really will go.
Then you really will go. So it was this long, minuscule slowing it down. And all the tyres had just gone like volcanoes on the rear tyres had just blistered.
But it's not a smooth surface there either, is it? It's
too
kind of
bad.
Pretty lumpy and bumpy.
It's a really tricky place.
I never thought about the wind, which is the bizarrest thing, because the wind was very stronger that day. So for half the lap, right, you're going round, the wind's pushing you up towards the barrier. So I've got a little more left lock on to hold it down. Because I mean, a lot of weight holding it down. And then you come, you know where the wind's coming. Then all of a sudden it starts shaking around a bit and it goes, the steering goes to neutral. And all of a sudden the wind's pushing you the other way. You say, whoa, no.
Probably the most stupid thing you've ever done, yes. I would have thought.
I'm terrified just listening to this story.
But I'm sure when Top Gear phoned you up and said we've got a Valkyrie to go around the Millbrook Bowl, would you like to beat Tiffany Dell's record?
I wouldn't do it. I think there has to be, if you're going to go in a car, which we might all do, there has to be an element of glory in it. You know, when I was upside, when the hearse went over for the last series of Top Gear, and I really thought I was in trouble then because the A pillar just came in and I had to dive into the footwell. I thought, you know, on your headstone, he died in a hearse had been painted blue, doing 40 miles an hour at Sweet Lamb, wherever it was. No, sorry, Walter's Arena. That's not what I envisaged.
Mine would have been, for comic relief. He died for comic relief.
Okay, well, we can take a quick break there. So go and have a comfort break go on to Amazon and see if you can find a copy of, what's it, Tiff Gear.
Excellent.
It's a fantastic read. And
there are some also at Thruxton. If you go to www.thruxtonracing.com, while you're buying a book which can be signed by the author, you can also book 3 laps as a passenger ride my other job with me in a BMW M4.
How much is a ride?
£155, sir.
£155 for a ride. If you pay £170, he'll be quiet. He won't talk, all right? We'll see you in a minute.
Collecting Cars, the safe, smart and simple way to buy and sell collectible cars. An online auction platform for the UK and Europe. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also collectingcars.com.
The CollectingCars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
So welcome back. This will be a much shorter part two because we couldn't curtail part one because Tiff was in full flow.
What happens between part one and part two? We've got jingly adverts.
No adverts. No, this is a non-commercial activity now. But
so
you
what
never
happened
know.
Between part one and part two?
We're giving the audience a chance basically to go and have a wee or just to not hear you for a minute because I suspect there's been Tiff overload. They've had to sit down and contemplate your brilliance. They just can't soak up any more of it.
Yeah, okay, I didn't. It was worth a break. Yeah,
there is a little mention of the whole point, which the Collecting Cars auction platform, which I want to see, I hope, Tiff's orange Capri with a brown vinyl roof. Because if that ever shows up on the market, I am bidding immediately.
So current road cars, you're getting some modern metal now, aren't you? Because you've been doing your love cars thing.
The most embarrassing thing about my life is I don't own a car. I don't own a single car.
Well, you didn't need to because BMW gave you one for 20
years,
didn't they?
That's true. They've now given them to influencers now and they're not lending me one anymore. So I've had to go out and try and... I might have to buy how do you do that?
So what,
Chris? We do have a family, I'd lied, we do have the family X5 that's now, it's about 12 years old now, 120,000 miles.
Diesel or petrol?
Oh.
Let's get on to that.
I
know, I'm winding up. The one thing he's always been consistent on is when the diesel thing really became popular 15, 20 years ago when all manufacturers started making diesels, this one here, Mr. Nadell, just said, you don't need to be a scientist to spot there's lots of stuff that comes out the back of them. You can give me all the details you want. I totally agree with him. There's soot coming out of it. Yep. It comes out the factory and it's nice and it's good, but once those filters get filled up and you're 2 years in, they're filthy. And
we knew they were carcinogenic particulates causing cancer. A scientist knew it 20 years ago, but because global warming and CO2 became the politically trendy thing, they pushed everyone into diesels, knowing that they damage human beings.
But your reason for not having one is because they're just disgusting things to fill up, aren't they?
Because you have to put suppository gloves on to put the pump because and the motorcyclists slip on the horrible greasy oil. You start them up in the morning to run. It's hot, you know. It's a cold morning. And then you get your case to go back to your car. You can't get near your car because the odious smell coming out of your car on tickover.
Have you ever owned a diesel?
No, never will. I have to now buy a car. So I'm looking. I'm going to be second hand. I can't be bothered with all buying all on the internet or not on.
Get a BMW
contract.
335i.
It'll be a 530 touring.
Yeah. You like your BMWs, don't you?
Yeah, I do feel happy. Even though they're now not lending me one, I'm still like BMW. In fact, funny enough, when I was on Top Gear on television, they said, well, you can't keep borrowing BMWs. So we can't let you do BMW stories because you obviously be biased towards them. So I said, look, what do you think is a better endorsement for a car company? That I tell people I drive BMWs because they lend them to me, I like BMWs because I bought one, which is a stronger endorsement to the car company. Oh, they gave up after that. No, I do like BMWs. I mean, they're all getting soft. I recently drove the new M5 round Goodwood and I was a bit disappointed, to put it mildly.
I do think Goodwood's quite a tall ask for a modern road car. I really do.
Well, the M4, the M2 were both brilliant.
Were they?
But
it's a 1.9-ton massive saloon car now, isn't it? I've got an E28 still. I've got an original black one from 85.
Where's your rally car? Oh, come on. I used to look forward to your videos and rallies.
I'm going to do one next year. But the problem is, how much motorsport have you paid for yourself?
Oh, just recently. Do you know how much it cost? It cost £450 to enter a Formula Ford race. Where did that money go? I had to buy a crash helmet 2 years ago.
I hadn't
bought a crash helmet since 1971.
Oh, the humiliation.
I had to buy a new race suit. I had to buy one of those stupid U-shaped things you put around your neck, which do nothing at all unless you're an IndyCar or NASCAR driving 200 miles an hour to a concrete wall. But no, someone tells you I've got to wear one of those stupid things. And yet, apparently, I can wear an open-face helmet with no balaclavas and my face gets burnt to pieces. And yet, I made you buy a fireproof suit. Why do you make me buy a fireproof suit and not make me put something in my face? I always wear a balaclava and a full-face helmet because it's for fire reasons. Why do they let professional rally drivers go on telly with bare, naked faces?
I don't have an answer for that.
No.
But you can always tell a sort of professional race driver, especially someone that's sort of been there and done it, because they're walking around the paddock in knackered old overalls and boots and a lid that probably went out of date years ago, because we just can't bring ourselves to actually
pay for
buy
it.
Fire
so expensive.
Stuff, you know, to get really
I remember
spoiled.
Doing, I had the privilege about 9-10 years ago of doing a race at Walter Hall at the Ring. We shared a Porsche, funnily enough, in a VLN race. And we had to go to scrutiny. He hadn't done a race in 10 years, 15 years, whatever. And that's when they just, the first year they were doing full suit and underwear scrutineering. You know, if you didn't have the right labels on your socks, and he turned up and he had this manky, it looked like the cat had been sleeping on it. It was a short sleeve bit of Nomex. So short sleeve Nomex in itself is a bit wrong anyway. And he just handed it over to this woman who just went, no, nine. And he just said, this was good enough in Group B, it will do here. And he walked off. And he just walked off and just said, put a tick there. It was lovely.
Brilliant. How are those rally boys, the speed those modern cars do?
Did you watch the footage from Finland?
Ridiculously, just ridiculous.
The way they're flying in the air now, and if they trim them wrong, they do wheelies, don't they?
How there aren't more massive accidents. And spectators terrify me. I see how close they're still standing.
I had a go in one the other day. I had a go in the Hyundai.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, but as a piece of engineering, they're weighting the body panels differently across the corners to make them fly differently, to behave differently. Wow. So all the body panels, they have different body panels to go on according to the rallies. The engine block is billet aluminium block.
Wow.
I mean, what are they costing? As a piece of engineering, they're just absolutely stunning.
But how did you find it to drive? Because I feel like they only use an armful of lock now. Yeah, you know, so everything's so precise.
Ever since Loeb basically redefined the sport, in as much as he was a neat and tidy driver, he applied racing driver mentality to driving, and you know, he was much quicker than Colin. Of course, what we wanted to see was Colin, because it was just so sensational. So all the cars now, you brake, you excite the car on the way in, but the moment you're before the apex, you've got the wheel straight, and you let the diffs just drag you out. Right. It still looks pretty
spectacular. I upset some rally drivers on Twitter, because I thought, I wanted two-wheel drive, let's go back to rear-wheel drive, silhouettes, you know, cheaper, and then slower, so a section, you know, you'll see the car for longer, because it won't go through like a blinding flash of light. And, you know, they don't go oversteery, that's all, you know, neat and tidy. But and of course they all find one photo where the guy's got opposite lock. Yeah, of course, for an instant. But that's slow, a bit like what we've just been talking about track driving. If you get sideways in a modern rally car, you're going slow. You've got to have all your four wheels in line going straight.
I mean, they're spectacular through speed, but it's they're as outrageous now as Group B was in the 80s.
Notes. How do those drivers take on all that information that's about four corners ahead because they're arriving so fast?
They're just in the zone. When they finish a stage, you can see their eyes they're out there, aren't they? It's a remarkable sport at the moment. It's a shame it's not getting quite the audience it deserves, because this is definitely a peak point in rallying. You can see they're going to have to slow it down at some point.
Yeah.
And that will happen when they have to go electric, because they'll have another 150 kilograms to cart around, won't they? And that will slow them down.
I have huge respect for the guys in the passenger seat. I just did a classic car rally, which has some special stages, and my first experience reading pace notes, and it's really hard. If you're trying to read this thing, it looks like Chinese, and you're trying to keep an eye on the road ahead.
Oh, you can't do that. You've got to sense the corners.
Yeah, you've got to sense the corners. I didn't know any of this. So trying to keep up with it, and you've suddenly told your guy that there's a sort of easy left coming up, and actually it's a first gear right hand hairpin.
I love the challenge.
We did, because you did Rally GB a few times,
twice,
didn't you, with RAC?
Yeah, two RACs, yeah. It's just such an amazing challenge.
I did, I remember doing, the local rally to me was the Wydeen classic forest rally, where, you know, you've got gravel stages and trees to hit everywhere, and I did it with Dan Prosser, who's a great boy, mate of mine, motoring journalist. And we were a bunch of jokers. We bought a 325i for $2,000, and we thought we'd make a story out of it. Turned up, process on pace notes, I'm driving. We're not a well-matched team. We're not well-oiled. We haven't done much of it. We're coming down this straight, and I'm going as fast as this bloody thing will go. I'm wringing its neck. And 90 miles an hour between trees in a crap old 3 Series does feel really, feels like 200 on a track. And Dan, doing his best job, he's doing a really good job, and he goes, right, 400 into 5 right. And we were just doing 1-6 speed, so 5 was pretty quick.
Okay.
And I, you know, sometimes you do see a vanishing point and you think, I said, are you sure that's a 5? He goes, yeah, into 5 right, keep it pinned. And we got, as I was turning in, he went, 2! Just shouted, 2! We've got this. We watch it when we're pissed sometimes. I just shit myself and basically just throw all the lock on I can, and we end up halfway up this bank, just bare there, but for the grace of God.
Just having this belief in what you're being said.
When it works, though, I've only done 5 or 6 rallies, but when you do get this lovely symbiotic relationship, and when it starts to flow, it's unlike anything else you've done.
I tell the story, I liken it to speaking a foreign language.
Yeah.
That we've, incredible, these, you know, Swedes and French, and I said, AAL with my big friend, we used to race a lot in Japan, I said, well, how do you speak English so well, and how does it get through? And he said, the big trick is you have to think in English. So we were learning our schoolboy French, you know, we'll listen to something and we'll translate it into English in their heads, then we'll translate it back to French for our answer. So it's that translation goes on. And I liken getting pace notes right to that.
Yeah.
That initially, when I used to use the 1-9, so 9 was a 90 degree, 1 was a 10 degree quarter, so it's 1 right over crest. So you set the car as 1, that's slightly right over a crest into, and that's another 50 yards, and then a left 9, that's a 90. So you spend a lot of time translating, and that almost takes too long.
You can't, it has to.
No. So what I did for the first couple of rallies, but eventually about the fourth rally, I did a great co-driver. And then all of a sudden, when he's saying it, the translation is there. So you instantly picture. So you don't have to translate.
And then the whole thing calms down and becomes more fluid, doesn't it?
What cars did you do it in? Oh, God, I did a Sierra Cosworth, Group N, though. So there was no handbrake. Couldn't handbrake turn around the tight corners.
You had a normal cable handbrake.
We had to do 3-point turns because you see the kids, usually these massive Scandi flicks. You're coming down a hill in a car that the track's only half the length of the car. And yet they were using the bushes, these huge Scandis. So in the pace lets, we put 3-point turn, the really stupid hairpins. So we had to do that. And you couldn't change down too quick because it had a standard gearbox used to go. So it was, but it used to accelerate like shit. So I was, you know, going up to 100 miles an hour, thinking, I wish I wasn't really going this fast, really. And then, of course, the second one was a Formula 2 Skoda front-wheel drive. And it was the icy one. And it was just ridiculous. I've never been so scared. I was scared. It's the only time in my life behind a steering wheel I've been scared. Because unfortunately, the rear brakes weren't working, which didn't help. I had no handbrake. And the ice. And I remember once I was coming this long, I could see an upside down thing in the middle of the track, sort of, you know, 500 yards away. So I thought, I suppose I better slow down. So I'm now pressing on all three pedals and neutral and gears, and I didn't seem to be slowing down. And this thing was getting closer and closer, and eventually I had to go up the bank and past it because I couldn't have stopped before it.
Wow.
I mean, a couple of times you shot off in the dark, bounced around and came back out the other side. How I survived that rally, I'll never know. Terrifying.
It was made for you, though, with the car control.
Yeah, what, front wheel drive with no handbrake working? Thanks, Chris. Exactly. And then I did the Scottish rally in a four wheel, in a front wheel drive Astra. I did a Hyundai Daihatsu Sharan one mate rally. In fact, that was when the pace notes worked, when I had Cliffy Simmons, a BBC correspondent in rally, as my co driver. He was brilliant. So, yeah, I'd love to do another rally, but it's so time-consuming. So you're so terrified when you only got one rally of binning it on stage one, and then you're sitting in the bushes waiting for some and feeling very embarrassed.
I've done that before.
But it's a circuit race. If you bin it, they'll bring it back on a truck, and you can go home quickly, but you have to sit.
So what are you going to do from now on, then? You're not going to retire, are you?
God, I can't. No, I still know. We don't all earn what Clarkson earns. That's always the problem. So I still
are you still mates with Clarkson?
Yeah, well, no, I see him occasionally, no, but not very often. He moves in higher circles these days.
Well, he couldn't move much lower than you,
no,
could he, really?
No.
But was it your book or someone's book? Was it your book?
It might be the forward he gave.
Forward, yeah, basically said that you were the greatest drinker on the planet.
Yeah, and right at the end he said, but he's a nice bloke.
Oh, there you
go. Type of Clarkson, you know, ripped me to shreds, you know, saying I was so old and permanently drunk, and then he just at the end he said, "Nice bloke. He's good, right? He's brilliant." I read the Sunday Times, his column on, not the car column, but his news
general
review.
It is superb. It's
great stuff.
It does constantly make you laugh.
Yeah. So now I'll still be doing laps around Thruxton, passenger rides to earn some money. I'll still be taking tour parties, Daytona 500. If you've got a motorpassion.com, join me.
You still do that? You do Mille Miglia? You do that still?
Mille Miglia, Spa. But off to Spa this weekend to look after the hosts of their
Motorpassion. Yeah, you just don't. You're Peter Pan.
And of course, YouTube. But obviously, Love Cars. So Love Cars is growing. So that's something that's going to take up more of my time. Play golf, charity golf days, love a round of golf.
What are you playing off at the moment?
Cricket. I'm still 18. I should be better. But
what about your beloved Swallows?
Enough.
You like your Swallows,
oh,
don't you?
I tweeted just recently.
Yeah,
fact,
I saw that.
Yeah, just they're all gone now. They've all gone. So lovely, little bits of nature. I love my. I live in a old rambling Victorian house, but it's a half price mansion. It's got a railway line through my property. I have property on the other side, and I mow it with my flail mower, my quad bike, and I love nature and chilling out there. The only trouble is I recently had an estimate for a fast charger because we'll be testing more electric cars. I had to go with the Tesla 3, which is very impressive. So I just got bored with it. That was my problem with these electric cars because we're drivers.
Yeah.
I wanted to turn some knobs and nurdles and change. You know, I couldn't do anything.
I'm going
to
buy one because I want to see what it's like.
But my old rambling Victorian electronics.
Has it not?
It will cost £1,000 to install a fast charge box.
But that's like an hour's work for you.
No, it used to be. Your Clarkson money again. You see, you keep on forgetting.
You've got to forget. You've got to leave that behind. He became bigger than you, Tiff. This is what happened, mate.
My wife's got to live a nice lifestyle that she got used to, and I'm trying to keep it going.
Holidays? You like the odd holiday?
Oh,
don't you?
Love Sri Lanka.
You love a
full
holiday.
Full family
don't you?
Holidays. Absolutely adore them. About one every 2 years, we go mad and spend way too much money to go to a beautiful deserted beach somewhere with the kids. Very lucky our three sons come with us. They haven't got too involved with women and marriage, so they'll come with us without bringing girlfriends and trouble. Because girlfriends and mother-in-law, that's a very dodgy.
But fundamentally,
area.
Your glass has always been half full, hasn't it?
Yeah. So we're still really enjoying a race at Goob. I saw my little Formula Ford. I bought back the car that I won in the magazine competition, 71. So I'll be racing that a couple of times next year.
And then when you feel you've been taken out, you use your social media might to bully the person that didn't take
Bully the person. Rick Morris does not need bullying. Let me make this perfectly clear. The man that was challenged Senna in Formula Ford and still think he drives like Senna, I think. Did you see that child? That child in the Renault Clios at Thruxton on telly? Coming into the truck, desperate overtaking manoeuvre, like young children do, who believe Senna's most ridiculous comment about you're not a racing driver. Was he talking to Sterling
Moss? If you no longer go for the gap.
Jackie Stewart.
Yeah, if you no longer go for the gap,
you're not a racing driver. So, of course, the bloke's blocking, and so the only way you can go for the gap is to put the after car on the grass, off track limits. So when he comes, T-bones the leader, takes him out, wins the race. You know, and he's been interviewed afterwards, I did nothing wrong. I saw a gap and I went for it. It was only half a fucking gap. It wasn't a whole gap. And this is what the children do now. They'll just go for any gap. I can't get hurt. Daddy will pay for a new car. No respect.
But also protection. You feel safe in that big tin box. You wouldn't try that in a Formula Ford, would you? Because you'd end up with no
Rick
legs.
Rick Morris did. He said I didn't give him enough room. Twat.
Fantastic. Look, I think we're gonna call it a halt there. It's been a pleasure having you on. You're gonna come on again because there's still so much more rubbish to talk to.
Enjoy watching you on Top Gear. I have to fast forward through some of it, but Lotus 79, I just was crying for you.
And I hate to say it, however much you annoy what I do on television, you're most responsible for the way that I do it. Because obviously you were the one that we all wanted to copy. I mean, I could do without you've got more hair than me, which is really difficult to deal with given that you're 67 years old and I'm not. But you have, on behalf of everyone that loves watching cars on telly, a big thank you from all of us.
Well,
that's the heartfelt
Chris.
Bit. Very best of luck at Goodwood. I can't be there because I have to go and film a flipping television programme. So do well in the TT. Do well in the Kinrara. What's it on? St Mary's as well, is it?
St Mary's as well, yeah. Three races.
Yeah. Enjoy it. It is the best weekend, isn't
it? Thank you. Love to all your podcast listeners.
Okay. Cheers, guys. So that's goodbye from me, Chris Harris, Sam Hancock. That's at Hancock_Sam and Tiff Nadell, who for some reason got an underscore, but I can't believe there's any other Tiff Nadells on the planet. Is there another person called Tiff Nadell on the planet?
Doubt it. Actually, I'm thinking of a new career. I'm going to have the change done. Tiffany Dell. People think I'm Tiffany Dell. I'm going to do it. I'm going to have the full thing, trans. The publicity I get.
If I was you, just tuck it in between your legs and walk differently. Then you can pop it back out when need it. Okay. There you go. There's some advice.
You could enter Formula Woman and start your career all over again.
I'll be there.
There you go. Tiffany Dell wins Formula W. Cheers, guys. Bye-bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.